Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll go get started here with the latest on the Pakistan Army's offensive against the Taliban in South Waziristan. We'll go to Islamabad in Pakistan to talk with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, who's a professor of physics at the Qaidi Assam University in Islamabad, where he's taught for over 35 years. He holds a PhD in nuclear physics from MIT and has received a number of prestigious awards for his contributions to education in Pakistan and the UNESCO 2003 Kalinga Prize for the popularization of science. He is the member of the Permanent Monitoring Panel on Terrorism of the World Federation of Scientists, and Dr. Hoodboy is involved in social activism, promoting women's rights, environmental protection, education, and nuclear disarmament. And he's the author of Islam and Science, Religious Orthodoxy and the Battle for Rationality, which is now published in 7 languages. And then we'll look at the state of American political ideology to try and understand the vocal minority who dominate the headlines with a dedicated outlet for their views, Fox News, who have launched a propaganda war against the White House, prompting Anita Dunn, the White House Communications Director, to announce this week that as Fox News is undertaking a war against Barack Obama and the White House, we don't need to pretend that this is the way that legitimate news organizations behave. And then we will look at the governor's race in Texas, which is shaping up as a referendum on the direction the Republican Party will take in 2010, whether the teabaggers, secessionists, and creationists will carry the mantle or more traditional conservatives will survive. We'll be joined by Wayne Slater, who's a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, a position he's held for 15 years as the Austin bureau chief. He's the co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And he's reported on a number of political public figures, including Pope John Paul II, Presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, both George Bush's, and he's traveled for 16 months covering the presidential campaign of George W. Bush and every Republican Democratic National Convention since 1988, and seven sessions of the Texas legislature and the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, and Rick Perry. Now let's go to Islamabad in Pakistan. We've been trying for some time to get a clean line. I think we probably won't get the best line, but we are talking to a prominent critic of the military, so perhaps that's one of the reasons why the lines aren't particularly good. I'm speaking with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, who's a professor of physics at Qaidi Assam University in Islamabad, Pakistan, where he's taught for over 35 years. He holds a PhD in nuclear physics from MIT and is the recipient of a number of prestigious awards for contribution to education in Pakistan and the UNESCO 2003 Kalinga Prize for the popularization of science. He is a member of the Permanent Monitoring Panel on Terrorism of the World Federation of Scientists, and Dr. Hoodboy is involved in social activism, promoting women's rights, environmental protection, education, and nuclear disarmament. He's the author of Islam and Science, Religious Orthodoxy, and the Battle for Rationality, now in 7 languages. And as we speak, Dr. Hoodboy, the Pakistan Army is engaging the Taliban in South Waziristan. What is the latest that you understand in terms of how that offensive is going?
Well, the offensive has been launched, and it's been launched after a number of offensives that the Taliban has carried out in cities in Pakistan, particularly Lahore and Kohat. Now, the army had been contemplating this offensive for something like 3 months or so. And the reason was that since 2003, that area of Pakistan has been essentially out of the control of the central government and of the army. This was where the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda had gathered together and this was where there was an alternative center of power. So in 2004, the Pakistan government had been forced to negotiate with the insurgents, and they had essentially ceded control to them. In fact, there has been an Islamic emirate that has been operated independently of the state of Pakistan. Now, the state has been forced to confront the fact that these people are completely out of control, that they are launching attacks within population centers in Pakistan, and that left by themselves, there will be no chance of controlling the terrorism that is swamping our cities at the moment.
And when you say an Islamic emirate has been established in South Waziristan, it seems to be tribally based around the Massoud tribe, right? Of course, their leader was recently killed by a U.S. drone. And I understand in North Waziristan, it's the Haqqani tribe. So give us a sense of how these Islamic emirates are tribally based.
In Waziristan, there are two principal tribes. There are the Massouds and there are the Waziris. Now, since 9/11, the Pakistani government has been confronted with the fact that the Taliban, who were fleeing from Afghanistan, had entered this border area. Now, South Waziristan borders Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, as well as Balochistan. Balochistan is the southern tip of one of the provinces of Pakistan. Now, given the fact that the situation had run out of control, that the Taliban who had come from Afghanistan had essentially taken over the local administration, that they had driven the Pakistani forces out, it was forced to make concessions, and it made a series of treaties, beginning with that of Shekai in 2004. So it had hoped that by making these concessions, that the Taliban would essentially confine themselves into Waziristan. But then what happened was that the influence of the Taliban then proceeded inwards into Pakistan. And so although one had not heard of the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, that is the Pakistani Taliban movement, until something like 2005 or so, but suddenly we were confronted with the fact that they were pretty much all over, and they spread even to the area of Swat, which is towards the north. And that's where there was a major confrontation earlier this year between the Pakistani forces and the Taliban, which ended up with the Pakistani forces eventually overpowering the Taliban there. But now, since the Taliban are very much entrenched, they have like their headquarters in South Waziristan, where now the offensive is to be launched. Your question was, what about North Waziristan? Well, North Waziristan is where there is a section of the pro-Pakistani Taliban, or what we call the good Taliban, and they are headed by the Haqqani group, Jalaluddin Haqqani, as well as his son, Sirajuddin Haqqani, former allies of the U.S., but now they have turned very much against the U.S., and they are the people who are thought of as the principal enemies by the U.S., but they're thought of as allies of Pakistani forces. So it's a complicated situation.
Well, I understand, though, that, of course, there were just some very flagrant and brazen attacks on military headquarters in Rawalpindi and police training barracks as well. And there's an indication that the Taliban may have allies in the Punjab, and that there was a meeting, a kind of terrorist convention recently held in Lahore. So does this indicate that either one, that Pakistan government has been too lenient, or two, they're simply not aware of the depth of the challenge to the very state of Pakistan?
The Pakistani state certainly has underestimated the strength of the Taliban and their ability to penetrate into the very depths of the security institutions. So it came as a terrible shock, not just for the army, but for the country as a whole, that a group of Taliban were able to penetrate into the general headquarters in Rawalpindi, which is something like 10 miles away from where I am at the present moment. They obviously were colluding with people inside, and for something like 20 hours, they held hostage 40 people. Lots of people were killed. And then just a day after that, there was an organized attack on police institutions in Lahore, which is about 200 miles from here. And three of them were simultaneously attacked, while two other institutions, police institutions, were attacked in Kohat, which is about 200 miles from Lahore. So all of this has come as a great shock to the Pakistani state. It knows that it is embattled, and this sort of thing has spread quite a bit of despondency into the country. It's an indication that it's going to be a long haul up ahead.
So what would be the, Dr. Pervez Hoodbhoy, what would be the correlation of forces, if you will, in terms of the Pakistani population? What percentage support the insurgents? What percentage are despondent, as you have just said? And what percentage are determined to take back control of state institutions?
I'd say that majority of people in Pakistan today are appalled by the fact that the Taliban are attacking the Pakistani state, its institutions, meaning its army and its police, and they do not support it. On the other hand, there's a huge amount of confusion. They are asking, well, is this really the Taliban acting by themselves, or is it external forces that are making them do this? In fact, the Interior Minister and the Minister in terms of security, he said, well, it's got to be external forces. They couldn't have done it by themselves. And so conspiracy theories are being invoked.
Well, the conspiracy. The conspiracy theories imply anti-Americanism, don't they?
I'm afraid so. That is something that I believe seriously weakens us, because anytime such an attack occurs, they say, well, they couldn't have done it by themselves. There must be something behind it, and what's behind it is Blackwater and the Americans. And now, to me personally, that is utterly absurd. I don't see why the Americans would want the Pakistan army to be attacked, especially when they're giving such a lot of money for that, and they've declared support for that, and there's simply no reason why that should happen. And yet, to the public mind, it's not obvious. And on television, you would have, I have had very many arguments with people who have said, no, this is all part of a grand conspiracy. Now, that's rubbish to my mind. But how one makes it clear, I still don't know how to do that.
So does this mean that, I mean, this is hard for, obviously, for Americans to understand, since the United States Senate just have given $7.5 billion in civilian aid to the state of Pakistan, along with $2.5 billion of military aid. I take it that the conspiracy comes out of what's happening in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan being a traditional ally, shall we say, or even surrogate of Pakistan. The belief system is what? That the Americans are spreading their empire through Afghanistan? I mean, try and give us a sense of this this thinking that's going on, this conspiratorial thinking that's going on inside of Pakistan.
Well, let's take the bill that you just mentioned. It was sponsored by Kerry. It's called the Kerry-Lugar Bill. And it aims at giving $1.5 billion a year to Pakistan for a period of 5 years. It's aimed principally at providing aid for education, health, construction of roads, civilian infrastructure, and so forth. But it comes with a set of conditionalities. And this bill has been the subject of intense debate in the Pakistani media. Now, the fears that have been, or rather the opposition that has been voiced, is that this bill is a means of controlling Pakistan. The conditionalities it imposes upon Pakistan's sovereignty. And that happens to be, I'd say, a majority view. Now, I personally think that the conditionalities are rather fair. Conditionalities are that this aid will be given so long as that there is a civilian government in Pakistan, and it will not be given to a military government. And I think that's exactly what the civil society in Pakistan has been fighting for. It has demanded that the United States not aid military dictatorships, and so this is a fulfillment of that. So personally, I would support it. Then, in terms of the bill saying that terrorist group in Pakistan, such as the Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, such as the Jaish-e-Mohammed, which are located in Punjab, in Murid case specifically, and then the Taliban in Quetta, the Pakistan government ought to move against them. And personally, I would agree with that. But there is a feeling in the country that is being pushed to do the right thing for by the wrong people. And so the United States is being blamed as imposing conditions that that reduce Pakistan to the state of a client of slavery, as is commonly said over here. And I think this is an excessive reaction, but it's a reaction that one can understand if one looks at the history of U.S.-Pakistan relations. Now, I think that President Obama has done a lot to move us away from the time of George W. Bush. I think at times people in Pakistan will realize that and will appreciate that. But so far, it's, I guess, just a hope.
Well, Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, as much as the Pakistani people may blame the Americans or be suspicious of their motives, there is a growing awareness here in the United States that America's ally, Pakistan, is aiding the Taliban, who are killing American soldiers in Afghanistan. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for President Obama to—he clearly is caught between the military, who deliberately leaked a request for 40,000 more troops, and other civilian leadership that's saying we need a smaller footprint. He hasn't made up his mind, but it's clear that he will send at least 40,000 because he simply will not rebuke his own military. But as the U.S. escalates militarily in Afghanistan, there's a growing feeling here in this country that, one, you can't win a war without a government, and that the Karzai government is a cruel joke. They just stole an election. It's an absurdity to imagine you can build a nation without a government. And the long and the short of it is, this is a very long-winded question, I recognize, but I think it will come the day here in the United States that the American people will say, get out of Afghanistan and get out of Pakistan. We've had it.
Well, I have no doubt in my mind that the United States should get out of Afghanistan, but I don't think it should do so right away. I don't think it should do so precipitously, because the cost to the Afghan population will be far too large. Yes, the United States bears a lot of responsibility for what has happened in this region, but now it has to clear up the mess before it leaves. And so I wouldn't, although I am anti-war, I've always been anti-war, but I don't think that the cut and run would be the right thing to do at this stage. And so until some kind of mechanism is put into place to prevent the Taliban from taking over Kabul and other cities in Afghanistan, I do believe that the United States and NATO should maintain some kind of presence over there. It's important to do that from the point of view of reducing the total amount of human suffering that would be involved. Now, I also see another dimension of that. If the United States were to announce that it is going to leave Afghanistan immediately, I think that that would substantially cut into Pakistan's resolve into fighting the Taliban, which I believe it must do so for its own reasons, for the fact that it does not want to be run over by religious extremists. And remember that Pakistan and Afghanistan are very different countries. Pakistan has seen this upsurge in religious extremism, a good portion of which comes from across the border. And a victory for the Taliban in Afghanistan would be devastating for us here in Pakistan.
And do you believe that that is a recognition that the Pakistan military and the intelligence service share? Because there's a lot of evidence that the intelligence service, the ISI, is secretly helping the Taliban.
Look, there are wheels within wheels. And what you say is right, that yes, the Pakistani intelligence and military has helped the Taliban in the past, and in fact, still continues to make a distinction between the good Taliban and the bad Taliban. The good Taliban are those who will help Pakistan eventually to establish its influence in Afghanistan. Because, you see, people see the Americans moving out of Afghanistan at some point, maybe not too far in the future, maybe even as much as, let's say, 2 years or 3 years from now. So then what happens, they ask? They say, well, the Indians will move in. Remember that Pakistan's thinking is strongly Indo-centric. They just think in terms of, well, we're in competition with the Indians. And so there is, within the Pakistani military, a definite kind of thinking that we must support those Taliban who are friendly to us. On the other hand, there are Taliban who are directly attacking us, who are killing our soldiers and treating the prisoners so brutally, in fact, decapitating them. And so they have to be fought against. So the Pakistani military is fraught with confusion. It still hasn't completely made up its mind. But the very fact that it went into Swat and launched a successful military operation over there against the Taliban, after having tolerated and some say encouraged them for something like 3 to 4 years, well, that's proof that the times are changing. And now, this is why I say that the United States moving out of Afghanistan precipitously, too fast, would be bad, would be bad for not just Afghanistan, but worse for Pakistan. So there has to be a graduated withdrawal with some kind of guarantee or some kind of hope that Afghanistan would not fall to the Taliban.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles here today, Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, and giving us a local Pakistani view of what's happening. And I appreciate your time today.
Certainly.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, Professor of Physics at the Qaidi Assam University in Islamabad, Pakistan. He's also a member of the Permanent Monitoring Panel on Terrorism for the World Federation of Scientists and the author of Islam and Science, Religious Orthodoxy and the Battle for Rationality. Let's now turn to the subject of American political ideology. I'm joined by Carl Agnew, who is a founding partner of Gerstein Agnew, a Washington, D.C.-based firm which provides strategy, message, and research services to corporate, political, and nonprofit clients. Agnew has conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns at every level, from municipal elections to congressional, gubernatorial, and national elections, and he developed the messaging for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. Carl Agnew is the principal author of a new study, The State of American Political Ideology, 2009, for the Center for American Progress, just released and available at americanprogress.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Carl, and I take it that you were also on this study that you headed up. You also worked with the former pollster for the Clinton administration, Stan Greenberg, and also James Carville.
Yes, the most recent project that we worked on was a study of conservative Republican-based voters done for Democracy Court. It's separate from the project we did for Center for American Progress, but obviously all dealing with many of the same issues.
And why? What was the purpose of commissioning this study?
Well, it really came out of, in 2008, one of the most important stories, one of the most enduring stories of the 2008 election was how closely aligned Democrats and independents were. Ultimately, independents gave Democrats at the congressional level, but also President Obama, huge majorities, and really swung the election toward him in significant margin. The flip side of that, which didn't get as much attention during the election, was the growing gap between independents and Republicans, particularly that Republican base, and how far isolated they were, not just in terms of vote preference, but also in terms of their attitudes on a wide variety of issues. And so as the political environment has shifted during these first 9 months of the Obama presidency, and independents have pulled back from Obama and the Democrats in some ways, we wanted to see if they were pulling closer toward the Republicans or if the Republican base was really isolated still out, as we said, in a world on its own. And what we found is very much that is the case. Independents are pulling back a bit from Democrats. They have some doubts, but they're certainly not embracing Republicans. The Republican base, if anything, is moving even further away from the middle and isolating itself even further.
So in trying to understand this vocal minority who appear to dominate the headlines, clearly what your study shows is that they have a dedicated outlet in Fox News. And just this week, the White House Communications Director, Ann Dunn, said that as Fox News, are undertaking a war against Barack Obama and the White House, we don't need to pretend that this is the way that legitimate news organizations behave. So it looks as though the White House is declaring war on Fox News. And from what I understand, the one thing that your study was unequivocal about is that Fox News speaks for this group, this alliance of teabaggers, secessionists, and the creationists?
Well, in their opinion, it doesn't speak for them. In their opinion, the mainstream media, which they they use mainstream and liberal interchangeably when describing it, is so biased and so far from reporting the objective truth that it makes Fox look conservative. But in reality, Fox is one of the participants actually referred to them as the truth tellers, which I thought was a good tag to really capture their views. You know, they believe that Fox is the only place where you can get objective, true information, and that the rest of the media is really trying to drive a liberal agenda and trying to actively hide certain information from the American public. And so they don't believe that Fox News reflects their point of view. They believe Fox News gives them the facts, whereas all of the others are trying to pervert the facts.
Well, I'm personally quite fascinated to understand how that belief system could be generated. I'm with the Pacifica organization, which is as far to the left as you have in the American media, and it's facing bankruptcy from internal divisions. It's even though it's worth $500 million, it's powerless in the media through its own fratricide. So nobody can convince me that there is a left wing media that has any power and influence.
It was really striking. You know, one of the principal findings was that this group, the Republican based voters, they are cognizant of the fact that they are a minority in the country, and they almost celebrate that fact.
But can you address this myth of the liberal media?
Well, this is what I'm getting to. One of the fundamental things in order to know whether you're part of that group or not is your understanding of the fact that the liberal media is at the root of almost everything that is wrong with our political discourse today. If you don't understand that, you can't even enter into the conversation. In their opinion, you know, you're not really fit to talk about politics because you obviously don't understand the reality of the political environment in this country. It's so fundamental to their worldview. The power of the liberal media and the strong agenda of the liberal media. And they don't see it as any one specific outlet. They see it as, you know, a wide range of them that are working loosely in, not necessarily in confederation, but all driving a similar point of view and a similar agenda. They don't offer a lot of proof points to it because it's almost a given to them, you know, and we probed on that. We tried to ask for some specific examples, and they talked about a few that had clearly been highlighted on Fox News and affiliated programs. But for the most part, it's just a given, and it's so self-evident that it's really hard to enter into the conversation with them in a lot of ways.
So in other words, it's just set in stone, and it's no longer questioned.
Absolutely not.
I see. Well, the one thing that is striking about your study is that I assume most people thought that there was a racist component in this resurgent of hatred and paranoia about Obama, which appears to be a kind of way to give people permission to hate him, not because he's a black man, which obviously would be politically incorrect, but to hate him for all kinds of specious reasons, that he's a stealth Muslim or a stealth socialist or a stealth fascist, or, I mean, it's all over the map. But I take it that your study says that these people aren't motivated by racism.
Yeah, during the campaign, race came up much more frequently with these types of voters, Republican-based voters, and we also did some groups with independents, older, non-college, white independents who are the most Republican-leaning among the independent groups. And among both of those during the campaign, race came up frequently. Race comes up not nearly as much now, and it seems to have really been subsumed. You know, we're not saying that these people have abandoned whatever attitudes they had toward race, but it's really been subsumed into a larger worldview now that sees Obama advancing a very detailed and very ruthless hidden agenda, which in their minds is very clearly designed to destroy the country as it was conceived by the founders and the, you know, the capitalist democracy that we've been advancing for 200 plus years. They believe his ultimate goal is to bring an end to that.
To bring an end to it, and they don't see the connection that it was the last administration that brought the global economy to the brink of collapse?
I think the fundamental difference in their point of view, they see the Bush presidency ultimately as a failure, as an embarrassment to true conservatives. They have a lot of problems with it, but they always believe in his heart that Bush was doing what was best for the country. They believe that Obama is not doing what he feels is best for the country. The policies he's enacting or that he's advancing are not in response to the economic crisis. They're not in response to the energy situation in the country. They're part of a step-by-step agenda to ultimately bring this country to its knees, to bankrupt it, to bring a failure to its corporations, to bring bankruptcy to its people, and to leave it so weakened that it ultimately has to accept what they believe is his ultimate goal, which is a socialist country.
And who would you identify as apart from Fox News? Maybe Fox News are the enablers of this ideology, but who are shaping and propagating this ideology?
A great deal of it really seems to come from Fox News. It's really the fulcrum. In every group that we spoke to, that was really where it was at. They saw conservative talk radio as an important piece and an outlet for their views, but Fox News was really the fulcrum for it. They talked about Glenn Beck in highly reverential terms. Limbaugh was kind of a mixed bag for them. He had a good message, but the messenger often got in the way. Glenn Beck was really the person who spoke most clearly and most powerfully. And a lot of the information he constantly tied back to Fox News, specific stories and coverage that came from Fox News. It was very clearly the central point where they were getting their information. And then there's also their social networks, undoubtedly, churches and other places where they gather play a role in this as well. But Fox News was really the clearest point of information.
Well, Carl Agnew, recently Glenn Beck teared up and broke down in one of his tirades, and the tirade was about a kind of atavistic wish for a world of Ozzie and Harriet, for a halcyon time in America when blacks and Hispanics were invisible, and it's a refrain that came up on the 9/12 demonstrations in Washington, and many times in when these town halls were disrupted, people say with genuine anguish, "I want my country back." So it seems to me that it's hard not to see a racist component here, because what the subtext of the Glenn Becks and the town hall disruptors and the teabag is, when they say they want their country back, they don't like the fact that the country is heading in this kind of multicultural, multiracial direction.
I think certainly that race plays a role. I think it's difficult to ascertain how much of it is about race, how much of it is about faith and its role in the public sphere, how much of it is just about simplicity and small town and just the size and scope of this country. The number of people, the difficulty of the issues, the rise of technology, there's so many different things that kind of play into this, and certainly we see huge age disparities here in attitudes. Even if you talk to Republican-based voters who are younger, you don't see a lot of the same attitudes that we see from these older conservative voters.
What do the younger ones feel? I mean, what's the difference?
Among them, we see greater openness to multiculturalism. We see race playing far less of a role. We see religious fundamentalism playing far less of a role. Even self-identified evangelicals among the millennial generation, those who are 18 to 29, they have much more lenient attitudes about same-sex marriage, about interracial relationships, about a whole range of social issues. So even those who do identify strongly with their faith and as evangelicals still don't share the strident views of the older generations.
And how would you characterize their conservatism? Assuming that this may, I mean, I'm going to be talking in a little while with Wayne Slade of the Dallas Morning News, and in many ways the gubernatorial election that's going on in Texas between Rick Perry and Kay Bailey Hutchison, it could be a referendum on the direction that the Republican Party is taking. So I'm curious to know about these young conservatives. What are they, just traditional conservatives? I mean,
they're highly patriotic, which I think is a term that means different things to different people. But to them, they feel that they're deeply committed to the country. They are much more likely to be economically nationalistic, to be opposed to free trade, to be much more about withdrawing from the world a bit.
A little bit of Ron Paul in there, is there?
Definitely a little bit of a more populist streak. Mm-hmm. One of the really striking things from this study that we just released on the conservative Republican base was how negative their attitudes were toward the Republican Party. They described it as old, weak, rudderless. They thought it was dominated by corrupt politicians, and that there was this growing gap between the people, the authentic conservatives of which they counted themselves a driving part, and the politicians, the power brokers in the party. And they were very negative about their party. They certainly had no openness to the Democratic Party in any way, shape, or form. But they saw their own party as weak and rudderless and really failing in its responsibility to stop Obama and to stop the march of this agenda that they believe he is driving.
So do they therefore identify with Sarah Palin, whose reputation is one as of an outsider, an insurgent, if you will?
It's funny. They were a little bit mixed on Palin in terms of her potential as a national candidate and a national leader, but they were overwhelmingly enthusiastic about her and what she represented. And again, the way that everything got back to the liberal media, they talked about her. They believed that she was victimized and attacked and unfairly treated by the media in a way that no other figure in American politics has ever been. One of the great quotes from the women's group that we did in outside of Atlanta, a woman said, "You know, I really think they did her dirty." I thought that it was a great, great way of really capturing what so many of them expressed. They really believed that she was targeted because the liberal media saw her and feared her. They believe that people genuinely feared Sarah Palin and went after her, and you know, they paint Saturday Night Live as part of this conspiracy, but they truly believe there was a coordinated effort to destroy her because she had the potential to be so powerful.
Well, just in closing then, Carl Agnew, since you've done this study, presumably largely for the benefit of the Democratic Party, I'm puzzled as to why the Democrats have allowed the right in this country to steal populism, given what just happened on Wall Street. When you hear what these people are saying at these teabag demonstrations and disrupting town halls, etc., it's a populist outrage at what's happened to the country, and particularly what's happened on Wall Street, which the Democrats ideologically should own. I mean, I cannot believe they're ceding this territory to the right, who basically support policies and politicians who created this mess in the first place.
From a personal point of view, I largely agree with that. I think that it's been a huge missed opportunity in terms of the economic populism opportunities here. For better or for worse, since, you know, LBJ left the Senate, central control has never been a strength of Democrats within the Democratic caucus. Republicans have been very good at it. You know, Tom DeLay was able to get every single member of his delegation to vote on virtually every single piece of legislation that mattered to him. Democrats do not have that kind of agreement. They're obviously, the larger the Democratic caucus has gotten and the more geographically and ideologically diverse it has become, it's become harder and harder to really adopt a single voice, and that's the real challenge. When you have the White House, you have the bully pulpit to a certain extent, but the voices within Congress are very mixed. And it's been a real challenge for Democrats to drive a consistent message.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Carl Agnew, and for your study.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Carl Agnew, who's the principal author of a new study, The State of American Political Ideology, 2009, a study done for the Center for American Progress, and it's available at americanprogress.org. I'm now speaking with Wayne Slater, who's a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, and a position he's held for 15 years as the Austin bureau chief. He's the co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller, Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And he's covered all of the presidential races, starting with the President Jimmy Carter and all of the seven sessions of the Texas legislature and the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clemens, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, and Rick Perry. And Wayne Slater, am I correct in suggesting here that the gubernatorial race in Texas is shaping up as a referendum on the direction the Republican Party might take in 2010, whether the teabaggers, secessionists, and creationists will carry the mantle, or whether the more traditional conservatives will survive?
You're exactly right. It is a sort of example, a microcosm of the larger conversation that's going on in the Republican Party. Do we veer to the right to what believers believe is a principled position with respect to abortion and gay rights and, I mean, gay marriage and other issues? Or does the party try to move a bit to the middle, to become a bit more appealing, a bit less, to basically make the face less harsh in order to build the party for the future? And what's happening in Texas is we have two candidates running for the Republican nomination for governor next March in the primary, the incumbent Rick Perry, who is appealing as best he can to the hard right of his party, and Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, who is attempting to, while she's conservative, to appeal to this more moderate route as a future for the party.
But it would seem that Kay Bailey Hutchison, even though she's very popular in the state, I understand, has an uphill battle because the people who vote in the primary, the Republican primary, would be largely the hardcore voters who are likely to support Perry, although I understand it is an open primary. So would Democrats and centrists and moderates also vote?
They could, absolutely. There's no restriction. And in fact, the Kay Bailey Hutchison people hope that moderates and some, maybe some Democrats do cross over in the primary. As you said, it is open. And if they want to vote in the, if anyone, anyone who wants to vote in the Democratic primary, Republican primary in Texas can do so. It's really, you know, this is really a problem for Kay Bailey Hutchison. And as you said accurately, just her attitude generally is more moderate, while his is much more conservative. But the key here is not what Texans believe, the full broad spectrum of Texans, or what Americans believe in the full broad ideological spectrum of the country. It is what do the people who show up, who are likely to show up next March in the Republican primary believe. And historically, in off-year elections, about 650,000 to 700,000 people show up. If that's who comes out next March, those are Rick Perry people. If Kay Bailey Hutchison is successful in appealing to, let's call them, a more moderate constituents within the party, folks who say, you know, this secessionist, birther, bircher part of the expression of the party is not us, then she's going to have to drive those numbers to a million people. I'm unclear as to what's going to happen right now, but it is exactly the same kind of debate that the Republican Party is having, as I said, in different places around the country. What do we do? How do we build a party? How pristine do we become? And if we do become pristine ideologically, do we suddenly become the perception? Is the perception that we are intolerant? And do we, as a party, move into 40 years in the wilderness? And that's an interesting debate.
Well, Governor Perry has already pandered to the elements that you're talking about, the Berthers and the Birchers. He's also appointed a creationist to the Texas School Board, and he's also called for secession in an off-the-cuff way, given this history of this country with the Civil War, it's an extraordinary thing for us, for any kind of prominent politician to say publicly. Is there going to be any backlash against that? I mean, I know there was a backlash in a lot of the states in this country who said, okay, you know, if you guys want to leave, here's the door.
You know, it's funny. I wrote a story, which probably you're referring
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I am referring to your story, sir.
In which I looked at the correspondence, the telephone calls, the emails, the letters from people both from within Texas and outside of Texas about the governor's sort of the governor raising the possibility of secession, the Texas not liking the federal government just may return to its former status as a republic. And that has a kind of among, in the Texas mythos, that has a kind of appeal among some people. And if you really read those letters, those emails, if you looked at those calls from within Texas, the issue was divided. Some people said, look, we believe in states' rights, we believe in state sovereignty, we even believe in the idea of secession if this evil federal government continues to oppress us and so forth. Other people were just the opposite, saying this is a goofy idea, you're making us look like racist backwoods rednecks, and enough is enough. Now that was from inside Texas. But I have to say, from outside Texas, the correspondence was almost uniformly, don't let the door hit you on the way out. We would love to see you leave. And in fact, I know that one writer of an email volunteered to help build a border fence to separate Texas from the rest of the country. So I don't think we're winning a lot of friends around the country. But again, I go back to this constituency that the governor and that Kay Bailey Hutchison is looking at. This is a very conservative state, the state of Texas. And even though this is the state of Molly Ivins and Ann Richards and Barbara Jordan and Toto, in the Republican primary, this is like a church. I mean, I go to the state conventions, state Republican Democrat conventions, and the state Republican convention is really a sort of a latter-day Pat Robertson event. And internal polls inside the governor's campaign show that in Texas, likely Republican voters go to church at least twice a week. Now, that's more than once. That's twice or more a week. Those are Baptists who go on Sunday morning and Wednesday night. And those are evangelicals and social conservatives who represent a large portion of this Republican constituency and will have a lot to say about this primary. It doesn't reflect the entire state, but it sure represents that group of very conservative voters who are going to make a decision next March as to who the next governor will be.
Again, I'm speaking with Wayne Slater, who's a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. We're talking about the upcoming gubernatorial race in Texas between the incumbent Governor Rick Perry and Kay Bailey Hutchison, the popular U.S. Senator. And how much, Wayne, will this case about how it's pretty clear, I believe, that Governor Perry stymied an inquiry into an arson murder case that resulted in a man being executed who may well be innocent. And many people on the commission, including outside experts, were heading in that direction.
This is an extraordinary case. As sort of, I guess, reflecting my earlier comments, Texans overwhelmingly support the death penalty. Polls show that about 3 out of 4 Texans are supportive of the death penalty, but really this is a social contract. And that support is contingent on a belief, in large part, that the death penalty, that capital punishment is fair, that the system works, that innocent people are not being killed. And so this episode, in which the governor refused to intervene back in 2004 in the execution of a man, and in subsequent days has refused to acknowledge the examination of independent experts who've raised questions about whether he's guilty or not, that whole episode potentially undermines the support for the death penalty of exactly the kind of voters that Rick Perry needs. The key here, and I have a story in Monday's Dallas Morning, that will be in Monday's Dallas Morning News, about the pure politics of this. If the governor can make this a dispute between experts, once upon a time, in the trial, experts said he was, the evidence pointed to his guilt. Subsequent experts with a different opinion say he could be guilty. So long as this is a dispute, then Governor Rick Perry wins, again, because he is playing to the side of those who support the death penalty. If Kay Bailey Hutchison, or frankly, if any critics of the death penalty can gain ground and raise questions about whether this system is fair. And we've seen, you know, since 2004, we've seen years of increasing scientific evidence, DNA, and the Innocence Project, and other things that have, I think, increasingly raised questions, even in the minds of Texans, of whether or not the system is fail-safe or if it's a problem. But this whole and if it is a problem, that is to say that innocent people could die, should we change our system? And is Governor Perry's steadfast adherence to the death penalty, while on the one hand it looks strong and rigorous from a Texas, the old Texas point of view, might that be politically damaging? But
We're running out of time, Wayne. But I'm just saying it's worse than that. Whether Perry knowingly or deliberately executed somebody and has covered up the fact that subsequently evidence points to his innocence, and that
this was a political catastrophe, I think, for him. Yeah. It's one thing to say different people's differ. It's another thing when he came in and changed members of the state commission.
Right.
And replace them with people whose sole purpose is to delay any hearing that would embarrass the governor. The appearance of a cover-up is politically damaging.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Wayne Slater. Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Wayne Slater, who's a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. And I'd like to thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Janie Coolidge, the assistant producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.